Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Graham Fuller, a former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, who is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East, and Breaking Faith, a novel of espionage and an American's crisis of conscience in Pakistan. And his latest novel is Bear, about the Great Bear Rainforest and eco-terrorism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian.
And even though it appears that this summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un seems to be in the works, there's been a couple of wrinkles. The newly appointed lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, said that the North Koreans were about to release the three American hostages, and suddenly that didn't happen. He said it was going to happen a couple of days ago, and it didn't happen. And then just today, the North Koreans, through their official spokesman, said the U.S. is deliberately provoking the DPRK at a time when the situation on the Korean Peninsula is moving towards peace and reconciliation. The spokesman warned the U.S. not to interpret Pyongyang's willingness to talk as a sign of weakness, saying that pressure and military threats won't work, and that because the U.S. is saying that pressure won't be eased until North Korea gives up its nuclear weapons completely. So we know that the South Korean leader will be at the White House on May the 22nd. From my understanding, that's where the real action is between the two Korean leaders, although obviously, this summit's very important. So let's start with that. How do you connect those two issues, the inter-Korean summit and the American-North Korean summit?
Well, there's no question that ultimately the issue at hand, the long-term issue at hand, is the relationship between the two Koreas and perhaps ultimately one day united Korea. So I think the conjunction of happening to have the present leader, the present president of South Korea, who is very keen and has long been interested in this process, and Kim Jong-un, who seems suddenly remarkably attuned to this, that is vital. On the other hand, as you just suggested earlier, Ian, the United States holds the ultimate spoiling card. If it doesn't want this to happen, I don't even know whether it needs to say to the South Koreans that, no, we're not going to go there. It could be that simply incidents in the background, I don't even know what they are, military, they may be covert, whatever else, could certainly throw a monkey wrench into the works and the entire thing. So, yeah, it's great that North and South Korea are talking and the atmospherics are good, but the U.S., for its own reasons, might decide in the end to scotch it.
Well, I don't think that decision would come from Trump, though. That's an extraordinary, scary prospect, because it seems to me that Trump desperately wants a win. He gets nothing but, as he said himself yesterday at a rally in Ohio, he gets nothing but bad press, even though his poll numbers are going up. And he's mired in deeply into scandal. It seems to be absolutely unyielding. He wants a win. I'm not sure that he cares about the details. He'll just sign whatever makes him look good. That seems to be who this man is. So would that mean that the battle behind the scenes is between the neoconservatives, who are represented by John Bolton, who was basically pushed into there, or you know, the person pushing him for that job was Sheldon Adelson. So he's tight with the neoconservatives. And then on the other side, Pompeo, who seems to be leading this initiative and who had the secret talks with Kim Jong-un, Pompeo is more of a protege of the Koch brothers. So he, I think, has a more libertarian, more realpolitik kind of attitude. So do you see that configuration in U.S. foreign policy, that the big donors behind this administration are pulling the strings?
Well, money always pulls strings in any administration and at every single level of Congress. It was Will Rogers who said that the United States has the best Congress that money can buy. I think the it's very interesting what the correlation of forces are. Bolton, I guess, would certainly qualify as a neoconservative, and that Pompeo has leanings towards the Koch brothers I find quite fascinating, because that could take the country in a very different foreign policy direction. I don't have much use for the Koch brothers at all on anything domestic, but I am encouraged that I think some of their libertarian thinking seems to be rather sensible. The other interesting aspect of this, though, Ian, is that traditionally, of course, the neoconservatives have been tied in very closely with Israel. That is their number one love, their number one goal. And anything touching the Middle East, obviously, it fully draws in the Israeli factor. I wonder how strong that is when we get over to the Far East. I don't know whether the Israelis as such have a dog in this fight in North Korea. Certainly, I think the Israelis and Netanyahu and that whole powerful conservative group would prefer a strong American imperial global presence, because they see Israel sees itself as tied to that and riding on the back of that. But, you know, whether they would move heaven and earth to try to stop it, or could stop Trump if he was really determined to do it, is not quite the same question. And the Pentagon itself, I think clearly the Pentagon would, speaking of it generically, would probably prefer the maintenance of, strongly prefer the maintenance of bases in South Korea and a major presence in East Asia. But, you know, how far are they willing to intervene to block it? God knows they can do it easily.
And again, I'm speaking with Graham Fuller, who's the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He's currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University, has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades, and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East, and Breaking Faith, a novel of espionage and an American's crisis of conscience in Pakistan. And his latest novel is Bear, about the Great Bear Rainforest and eco-terrorism. So I think that may be actually the division here, that the neocons have captured Middle East policy, at least vis-a-vis Iran, because it looks like Trump will pull out of the JCPOA, the P5+1 deal on May the 12th. And that's certainly something that Netanyahu's been pushing. Netanyahu's entree into the White House has not just Sheldon Adelson, it's also been Jared Kushner. The families are very close. He seems to have, his star seems to have dimmed a little bit. So maybe that is what's going on, that this is a separate theater and they don't have a dog in this fight. But what's your sense, though, of of China's role? Because Kim Jong-un did make that secret trip to China, and it feels like he was setting the table with the Chinese before proceeding to set the table with the South Koreans. And then, of course, in the interim, there were the secret meetings in Pyongyang with Mike Pompeo.
Yes, well, I think China's number one consideration in the entire region, or you might even say in the globe, is to prevent the U.S. from dominating the entire global agenda, either economically or geopolitically or otherwise. It doesn't mean defeat the U.S. or whatever, but it certainly means that they will not any longer accept a sole single superpower that the United States has prided itself on since the fall of the Soviet Union. I think that aspiration is now seriously weakened. But Russia also, who is a player in this, because Russia borders on North Korea and has been involved in North Korean politics for a long time, since really the end of World War II. So both of these two states, at the very least, have their number one goal is to make sure that the United States does not absolutely call all the shots. So if the U.S. pulls out of South Korea and no longer maintains that base, that is a net plus, I would argue, for both Russia and China in that area. On the other hand, on a more subtle level, it does present China with some slightly new problems, a more perhaps resolute, independent-minded South Korea. It's already somewhat in that area, but it would become even more so. United Korea would be a much stronger force on China's and Russia's border, if that should come to be. But I think both of those are preferable for China to deal with than dealing with American military power right on its doorstep, contestation of the whole South China Sea and the Taiwan issue.
Well, I would assume then that we know that the Chinese don't want a collapse in North Korea. They don't want the South Koreans and the Americans on the Yellow River again. So that is why they've been supporting the North. But also, I would assume that the Chinese are not happy with Kim Jong-un's nuclear program, because that's brought in more U.S. military assets and the THAAD system, which the Chinese are extremely upset about, and they, in fact, cut off their trade relations with South Korea over the U.S. deployment of the THAAD missile intercepting system in South Korea.
Well, that's exactly right. The last thing China wants is more American power and more American weapons in South Korea, which will have long-term implications for China-Japan policy, China-Taiwan policy, and the whole South China Sea. So, but I still say I think a removal of the immediate presence of American military there has to be the number one presence. And I'm impressed that how quickly both Kim Jong-un and Xi Jinping in China seem to have made up for the past serious tensions. This is quite astonishing. I mean, I think most of observers in the West had assumed that Kim Jong-un was something of a fool and isolated and out of touch with reality and everything else. I think he's shown himself extremely adroit and knowledgeable, and that trip to China was quite a stunning turnaround to bring the two into a much closer alliance in facing or supporting Kim in his talks with Trump and the U.S.
Well, of course, relations were pretty frosty because, after all, Kim, when he first came in, Kim Jong-un, the first thing he did was to kill his uncle, who was the liaison to Beijing, and then he killed his older half-brother using a binary form of nerve gas, a very advanced nerve gas at an airport in Malaysia, and his older half-brother was under the protection of the Chinese at the time. So clearly, things got off to a frosty start. So what's changed here is something obviously happened between the famous photo op of Mike Pence going to the Olympics in Winter Olympics in South Korea, and sort of sitting in front of Kim's sister, frozen like a sphinx, and then suddenly that went nowhere, and then suddenly the South Korean intelligence people, the National Security Advisor and the head of South Korean intelligence, show up in Pyongyang, and then they show up in the executive office building, and then somehow they're called into the White House, and they tell Trump that they had a very good meeting with Kim Jong-un, and without a hesitation, Trump agreed to a meeting. And gave nothing up in the traditional sense. And so this is not normal, is it, the way deals are made, that you always get
something?
No,
it isn't. On the other hand, I think just because Trump is impulsive doesn't always mean that it has to be wrong. In this case, and who knows what Trump's immediate impulses were, many people refer to smelling a Nobel Prize down the road or something. I think that's entirely possible, but there are worse reasons for having peace talks and smelling a Nobel Prize. I mean, one could alternatively go to war. So I wouldn't want to predict where Trump is going, but he continues to be unpredictable. And as I say, I think he's not under the immediate pressure and guidance of the pro-Israeli neocon movement, and maybe sensed a way out of this. It's interesting that Trump, for all his incredibly bellicose language, so far has avoided essentially large numbers of casualties around the world in American military actions. I mean, George Bush, at the same time in his career, was working his way up towards killing a million people. Trump hasn't even begun to do anything. It doesn't mean he might not, but he has not so far. So this may be slightly different impulse at work here. Who knows what the real Trump is, but I think it isn't necessarily bad that Trump felt that this was a positive thing to pursue rather than going through the very tiresome and medieval mechanisms sometimes that the American foreign policy establishment represents.
Well, the point that you're making, that George W. Bush is responsible for the death of a million or perhaps more for him, Cheney, and Rumsfeld and Rice's intervention in Iraq, the wounds of which...
And Afghanistan,
the wounds of which still continue to this day. That's well taken. Of course, a lot of people now are saying that George W. Bush looks good in a nostalgic way because people are alarmed at Trump and that by default, Bush looks good. But on the metric that you just mentioned, the fact that Trump has not been responsible for wholesale deaths abroad, as opposed to George W. Bush, is something I think to think about.
Yes, in the end, I mean, I'm afraid if you sit in the West, these deaths are all rather abstract in the Middle East, but they are very real, and they have destroyed country after country in the region, which, as you know, opens the door to chaos and certainly to terrorism, which is a powerful legacy of all of those wars, and far from over yet. So in that sense, I think maybe a distraction in a more positive direction in South Korea, in Korea's, would be welcome. But the U.S. has to decide whether it is willing to give up its a significant piece of territory in its military presence in East Asia.
I recall when George W. Bush was in Iraq meeting at a press conference with Nouri, the Iraqi leader, that an Iraqi journalist threw a shoe at George W. Bush and he ducked. But what the journalist said when he threw the shoe was, "You dog, you have destroyed my country and killed my people." That journalist is now running for parliament in Iraq.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's very interesting. Yeah, I don't think we have a clue here as to what the emotions are seething between the, beneath the surface in Iraq and Afghanistan, for that matter, or in Somalia or in Yemen or many of these other places where truly poisonous legacies are continuing. So maybe that's one reason why some of us at least are clinging on, maybe naively, who knows, feel a sense that the dynamic in East Asia is a bit different. Dealing with China is obviously a very different and complex thing, and the U.S. has a lot to balance off within its calculus about presence in Korea, presence, relations with Taiwan, and our immensely important relations with China.
Well, Graham Fuller, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Graham Fuller, who's a former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, who is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East, and Breaking Faith, a novel of espionage and an American's crisis of conscience in Pakistan. And his newest novel is Bear, about the great Bear rainforest and eco-terrorism.